I'm Michaela from The Millennial Outside. I'm a Nature Valley girl, a pasta addict, and a big fan of the phrase, you win some, you lose some. I wear lots of hats. This is me sharing my musings on the simple things in life that I find extraordinary. Can I tell you a story? The weekend before we got married, Topher and I and seven of our best friends boarded a plane for New Orleans. The drinking started with a round of mimosas at the airport. It wound its way through overly strong rum and cokes out of solo cups, adorned with bendy straws that spelled out hello and party in our Airbnb, a beautiful old building with a balcony overlooking the street and not quite enough beds. It continued down Bourbon Street with lime green drinks and Hawaiian punch-colored shots out of syringes. We landed in the Big Easy during Southern decadence, which was not, as we guessed, Louisiana's answer to Denver's New Year's Eve rave. Men of all ages and shapes and sizes wandered the streets in nothing but leather harnesses. Mardi Gras beads were thrown from balconies, and I danced on stage to early 2000s punk rock with every other bride to be in the bar. It was the picture-perfect New Orleans bachelorette party until the next morning when, by the third time I'd hugged the toilet, I thought for sure I was dying. By the sixth, as I was sitting on the floor, contemplating the dust bunnies under the clawfoot tub, Topher's EMT friend, hungover himself, diagnosed me with a, yeah, that's not good. By 8, the boys were off drinking again, and my friend Marion finally coaxed me to eat a slice of toast she'd made in the oven from a loaf of bread some of the more robust in our group had walked to the market to get early that morning. She'd made it directly on the oven rack because there was no toaster or pans. I kid you not when I say that humble piece of toast saved my life. In my engaged AF shirt from the night before, wedged into a bed with three of my girlfriends, I had the opportunity to consider toast in a way I never had before. The golden butter glistening in the tiny pools on the craggy surface, the slight resistance of the cooked exterior before it gives to a satisfying crunch, revealing its squishy innards. I thought of the Calvin and Hobbes strip, where they wonder where bread goes when they put it in the toaster and toast pops up. Magic. As a kid, I impatiently brushed toast aside in the mornings for toaster scrambles or the Bisquick biscuits I'd make while my sister and I watched cartoons. Powdered mix and milk shaped with a drinking glass and transformed into buttery goodness in the oven. It didn't matter if my mom doused it in cinnamon sugar or covered it in green dyed cream cheese on St. Patrick's Day. I never could appreciate the utter plainness of toast. I've never understood homemade sandwiches, so when I moved out, I never kept pre-sliced bread around. There was no opportunity for toast. Then I read about squirrel. Giant slabs of homemade bread smothered in ricotta and coated in wild-sounding jam flavors like quince and kumquat adorned the pages of the food magazines I read. When I found myself alone in LA with time to kill, I took my first Uber to stand in a 45-minute line to eat toast by myself on a stool. I started to understand. It might be the most millennial thing I've ever done to write about toast. After squirrel, I started to hop on the toast train. Back home, I'd order $10 avocado toast, sorry, tartine, as my favorite Scandinavian-inspired coffee shop calls it, or make my own, scattered with Trader Joe's everything but the bagel seasoning and hot sauce. I read a 2017 article about the origins of avocado toast from Bon Appetit. It went deep into why we roll our eyes at the basicness of ordering the ubiquitous dish now, but in 90s Australia, it was super cool. And when Instagram was invented, it was the height of everything everyone wanted to be. Cool, fashionable, and healthy-ish. But avocado on toast dates back even earlier, the first published mention, a 1920 SoCal newspaper article naming it one of the nicest ways of eating an avocado. Here in Denver, there's a hip wine bar that's always overflowing and impossible to get a seat at, unless you go super early or wait for hours on a park bench out front for a table to open up. I've done both, and while the wine selection is great, the real reason to go is the bruschetta boards. Brie, apple, fig, or burrata, bacon, arugula, tomato. Warm artichoke spread, or caprese. The options are endless, and I get hungry just thinking about it. Is bruschetta toast? Is a hot dog a sandwich? Never mind, don't answer that. And to my husband, when you listen to this, no, I do not want to debate this subject. I think it must be. Bruschetta being toast, that is. We're not having the hot dog debate. I also feel like when my best friend who studied abroad for a semester in Italy hears this, he's going to tell me I'm totally pronouncing it wrong. Is it bruschetta? Bruschetta? Not sure. Beautiful, fancy, almost unrecognizable toast. But toast it is. That must mean that garlic bread is also toast. And if that's the case, then I guess I've loved toast for a very long time. I just needed to come around to it in its purest form. As a kid, I also had very little patience for cheese pizza. When there were pepperoni glistening with oil and piping hot pineapple and caramelizing mushrooms and wrinkly black olives on deck, I couldn't imagine why there was always somebody at every birthday party who would only eat cheese. Boring. But then, when I worked at a pizzeria, I started to understand the fascination with cheese pizza. Done right, there's nothing I love more than a perfect cheese pie. Amazing crust, perfect sauce, high-quality mozzarella. I love the way the cheese forms little brown bubbles and the oil pools, and you can really taste every ingredient without the distraction of toppings. Buttered toast is toast in its purest form. It tastes better when it's the gorgeous Prussian rye my stepmom buys on special occasions, slathered with an unholy amount of Kerrygold butter, its sunshiny surface melting into pools, eaten over the sink. But I'll admit, it still tastes wonderful, beautiful, necessary, when it's just sandwich bread topped with cold, half-melted store-brand butter, semi-burnt thanks to an ancient toaster my dad found at a garage sale when he first moved out, its numbers worn away. When I Googled, why is toast great, it came up with all sorts of articles about why toast is the perfect comfort food. While I think that spot still goes to a bowl of mac and cheese or buttered noodles for me, I have to admit, toast is pretty comforting. Even the word toast sounds cozy. It recalls images of marshmallows roasted over a campfire and baseboard heaters in a log cabin and hot cocoa while the snow falls. And a neighbor kid who once yelled, "Look, Mom, I'm toasting," as he coasted down the street on his bike. Like a magic potion, that slice of toast in New Orleans healed me, and we ventured back out into the city. That afternoon, we ate powdered sugar-covered beignets at Café du Monde and shrimp po' boys. The next day, we went to a bucket list restaurant for me, Turkey and the Wolf, a sandwich shop serving up crazy concoctions on vintage McDonald's Happy Meal plates. In 2018, it had landed the number one spot on Bon Appetit's hot restaurant list. But the biggest food memory I have of that trip is still that perfectly golden piece of miraculous toast. Now, 2 years later, I say a little murmur of thanks to the humble piece of toast I'm seemingly always craving, apologizing that it took me 24 years to worship at the altar of bread and butter and electric coils.
One of my New Year's resolutions was to meditate every day. Let me tell you, it's not easy. As someone who often puts a podcast on while walking the dog or scrolls through Instagram while watching TV, focusing on a singular task at hand is hard enough for me, let alone focusing on nothing, or maybe focusing super hard on consciousness. I decided that maybe I needed a little instruction, so I'm halfway through Sam Harris's Waking Up course, and while I'm still not sure I understand what I'm doing or why, I can tell you it's not easy, but it does make me feel more calm and relaxed. So if you're like me and multitasking while listening to this podcast, take the next minute, where there could be an ad, but instead of asking you to invest in audiobooks or life insurance or something, I'm going to ask you to invest in your mental health. I've never been in a bamboo forest when the wind blows, but after listening to this audio clip, that's where I want to be. Take a minute and focus on whatever it is you're doing as you listen to the bamboo sway in the breeze.
I knew Japan had mountains, somewhere. While our honeymoon's itinerary was focused on the city streets of Kyoto and Osaka, and not the famous volcanoes to the north, home of the world's snowiest city and slopes filled with ghostly deciduous trees, I knew I wanted to at least get a taste of Japan's natural splendor. I stumbled upon a trail called the Kumanokoro. It was a sacred pilgrimage route established 1,000 years ago, crisscrossing the Kii Peninsula near Osaka. The various routes connected 3 shrines. While we didn't have several weeks to complete a full trek, photos of the misty green forests had me hooked. Using the official website, which was, thankfully, well translated, I booked us rooms in 2 guest houses for a 2-day trek from the village of Yunomine to one of the sacred shrines, Kumano Nachi Taisha. Topher and I mapped out a daunting public transportation journey, and we packed our hiking boots. After exploring Tokyo and Kyoto, we spent a night in Osaka before starting our journey into the mountains. After circling an Osaka train station 3 times, trying to find the entrance Google Maps had misled us to, we boarded a 2-hour train south to Kitanabe. As the train set off along the picturesque coast, a transit officer, his uniform perfectly pressed, complete with a peaked cap and suit jacket, looked at our tickets and frowned. This would be the first of many encounters where Topher's half semester of Japanese and the extremely patient and hospitable people of the Kii Peninsula's limited English were put to the test. We'd bought the wrong tickets, or perhaps only 1 of 2 tickets needed. These sorts of distinctions are lost on someone like me, whose only words of Japanese are the ubiquitous sumimasen, or excuse me, that rights all wrongs. Rather than berate us or throw us off the train, he patiently counted out the wad of money I thrust his way and sold us the right tickets, depositing the change back into my hand. The train left us in the town of Kitanabe on a sleepy Sunday afternoon. We found the Kumanokoro office, and they stored our suitcases for us, and we took off with only our 18-liter packs for the next 3 days. The women at the office told us the only place open in town for lunch was an overpriced, touristy restaurant. Our bus to Yunomine wasn't for another 2 hours. We sat on a bench in front of the train station and sadly contemplated the vending machines, me wishing I hadn't left my ever-present bag of matcha Kit Kats in my suitcase to save room. While we'd been thrilled to find coffee, ice cream, and beer vending machines on every corner, we were starving and needed more than sugar and alcohol. After 45 minutes, we tried a door on a whim and found a tiny ramen shop with no English in sight. The women at the office hadn't shared this local joint. We stumbled through the menu and ordered 2 bowls of ramen and 2 big beers, and it was less than $9, and incredible. Our spirits bolstered, I popped 2 Dramamine, and we boarded a bus into the mountains, listening to Memoirs of a Geisha on Audible through shared earbuds. The closer we got to Yunomine, the more twisting and turning the roads became. At dusk, we pulled into a town plucked straight from a fairy tale. The buildings hugged the verdant green hillsides. As the lights came on, they illuminated the fog from the onsen, or hot springs, that ran through the heart of the tiny town. We watched people boil eggs in one of the pools, steam kissing our faces. At the door to the guest house, our host greeted us enthusiastically and called me Mikaela-san. Sharing her home and a meal she and her husband cooked for us was a moment peering behind the lens. While the Japan that tourists see, I know, is not quite the real thing, staying at the guest house felt like peeling back one of the thousands of layers that makes up this beautiful country. We were led to our room, the floor covered in tatami, bamboo, mats. We changed into patterned robes called yukata, and I wrapped an ace bandage around the pineapple tattoo on my ankle, a no-no in a culture where tattoos are associated with Yakuza gang members. We donned the house shoes outside our door, which we switched for outdoor shoes just down the hallway to go to the onsen connected to the guest house. Another specific pair of communal shoes waited outside the bathroom. While I respect the no outside shoes in the house custom for cleanliness, the concept of communal shoes seems to defeat the purpose to me, but I wasn't going to complain. The onsen was divided into men's and women's pools. This was the moment of Japan I was most nervous for. The etiquette surrounding it swam through my head as I tried my very best not to be a stupid American gaijin. There were 2 other girls in the onsen when I arrived. I washed my body, as instructed by the internet, using the buckets and spigots along the wall before lowering myself into the pool fed by the onsen's scalding waters via a pipe that emptied into the enclosed bath. The girls were not onsen newbies like me and kept the pool a hot but tolerable temperature for the first few minutes I was there. But then they left and the hose which dispensed cold water got turned off and I was too nervous to even move as another older woman arrived. So I cooked myself like a lobster, my pale skin bright pink for the rest of the night. Gaijin, for sure. We dressed and headed to dinner, where we sat onto Tommy mats on the floor with two other groups. Our host enlisted the help of a Japanese girl who lived in Australia at the next table to translate our meal for us. We ate beautiful pieces of sashimi and tempura briefly touched to vibrant green matcha salt. All manner of pickled things and miso soup. A whole angry-looking fish with its eyes still staring up at us that the Japanese diners made quick work of while we accidentally shredded it with our chopsticks. It was one of the most beautiful meals I've ever eaten. The next morning dawned cold and rainy. We ate our breakfast back on the tatami mats. Nori dipped in soy, wrapped around fresh rice. More pickles and soup. Topher tried to drizzle the soy sauce directly on his rice and was quickly scolded by our host. We donned our cold, stiff hiking boots from the door and were ushered onto a bus, which dropped us and two other guys at the rainy trailhead. They quickly took off, and we were alone. We started up a cobblestone path behind some country houses that looked more like England than Japan. Fat, black creatures slithered across the trail, and I recalled with dread the poisonous snakes the pamphlet from the office had outlined. They were not snakes, we quickly realized, but massive earthworms, their bodies shimmering from black to incandescent purples and greens. What worlds had we alighted on? We climbed through the misty forest, the weather rarely letting up. The trees were so verdant green, we felt like we were in a jungle. Small altars and signs lined the path, marking each tenth of a kilometer. We only passed a handful of people all day. At lunch, we pulled out the beautifully packaged bento boxes our hosts had sent us off with, having joked all day that they contained the angry fish from dinner. While we'd gamely tried every culinary oddity Japan had thus far thrown our way, the bento boxes pushed our limits. We poked at the purple balls of rice and unidentifiable piles of this and that with our chopsticks, rain dripping off the hoods of our raincoats, and ate a granola bar. By the time we descended into the next village, 10 miles later, we were soaked to the bone. We passed a woman gardening, and she asked where we were headed and personally escorted us, at breakneck speed, the last half mile to our next guest house. It was an old school turned inn, and the floors were linoleum, and the main building was without heat. A wall unit in our room dispensed heat when you fed it yen, so we emptied our pockets, stripped off our soaking clothes, and crawled under all the blankets we could find. I'd been battling a cold all trip, but the cold, wet day turned it brutal. Topher barely slept all night, keeping the heater funded for me. There were no showers, just bucket baths and an icy bathroom, so I opted to stay gross and wet. We ate hot soup and another kaseki-style meal in a frigid cafeteria before hunkering back in our room. On the spotty Wi-Fi, we started plotting our escape. I was sick as a dog. Topher's bad knee was giving out, and the weather wasn't clearing. The prospect of another 10-mile hike, this one totally uphill, was unbearable. We found a tenuous bus schedule, and miraculously, it looked like one of the 3 buses per week that came through the all-but-abandoned town would be coming by in the morning. The next day, we sheepishly accepted the congratulatory pin for hiking from the enthusiastic man at the desk and pretended to tie our shoes as the other guests started down the trail. We skirted the guest house, making sure to stay out of eyesight of the front door, and found a shuttered-for-the-season post office with an ATM where we could withdraw cash. We waited at the bus stop, the fog hugging the hills. We boarded the bus with half a dozen old women already on it, congratulating ourselves on our self-sufficiency. Until we saw the sign. No bills bigger than 250 yen. The bus carried no change. We just pulled a 1,000 yen note, basically $100, out of the ATM. We calculated how far we could go with our remaining small bills and pulled the string when our money ran out. The driver pulled over on the side of a mountain road in the middle of nowhere and kept the doors closed. He wasn't about to abandon 2 lost and dirty Americans on the side of a back road. A painfully long and broken conversation between him and Topher ensued, the old ladies shifting impatiently in their seats. Finally, the driver took out his own wallet, made us change, and on our journey we continued. I was reminded of once when my sister rode the bus to visit me in Boulder. She only had a $20 bill, and the American bus driver took all her money for a $4 ride because they didn't do change. Each person in Japan we encountered reminded me of the vast and obvious differences in hospitality between our 2 countries. We were looked after and taken care of by strangers at every turn, something I would never expect and rarely find at home. We found our way to the shrine we'd planned to hike to and watched the waterfall plummet down the mountain and climbed a pagoda from which we could see the sea. Back at the train station, we met the driver from our hotel for the night. He attempted an urgent-sounding conversation with Topher before giving up, as neither understood the other. In the lobby, we were surrounded by the entire front desk staff, who gravely gave us a well-rehearsed one-liner. Poison. Highly confused, we each tried every which way to understand the other. In the end, the only information we gleaned was that we couldn't stay there. A phone with a translator app was shown to us again with the word poison. Guests ate in the restaurant and cars filled the lot, but we were loaded back into the car and hoped we weren't being kidnapped. We were driven to a very fancy-looking hotel, and our driver spoke to the desk, and we were led to a stunning room with a tiny Zen garden next to the door and a balcony hovering over the ocean. Again, we'd been taken impeccable care of, though we could barely even speak to each other. We didn't pay anything but an onsen use fee for the much nicer accommodations and are still to this day stumped as to what went down that afternoon. We donned our yakuta and headed our separate ways to beautiful outdoor onsens overlooking the sea, feeling like we were very lucky to be there, a million miles from home, in that perfect corner of the universe. We walked through the dark streets of the sleepy town to a tiny restaurant where we got the coast's specialty, tuna, served a multitude of different ways. There was whale on the menu, too, and I wondered how a people so deeply hospitable to strangers could eat such a majestic creature. The hotel staff had kept our key when we left, and as Topher told them our room number in Japanese upon our return, they waited eagerly and cheered when he got it right. We found a pastry shop the next morning where we discovered the wonder of Japanese baked goods and ate them on a bench overlooking the water, a tray of squid drying in the sun next to us. I felt little evidence in the last few years that humans as a whole care for one another, but Japan might be the exception. At every turn, we were cared for. Our strange and wild adventure on the Kii Peninsula is embedded in my memory, the kindness of a people to whom we were nothing.
Follow Sea Salt and Parm on Instagram, and don't forget to rate, subscribe, comment, and all those things podcasters normally ask for. You know the drill.